Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Elizabeth Bloomer Ford, Rosalind Smith Carter, Nancy Davis Reagan, Barbara Pierce Bush, Hillary Rodham Clinton, Laura Welch Bush, Michelle Obama, and Melania Trump. The last seven of our first ladies in the United States. This hour is all dedicated to our first ladies, 47 of them and all, putting them in historical context. Of course, excluding the current one who's only been in office, there is no office. I'm going to correct myself, who has been first lady for just over a year and joining us to talk about first ladies in historical history. Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics in our AIM studio. Diane Bystrom of Iowa State University, welcome to our program.
Well, thank you.
Tim Walch is with us in Iowa City, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library, a presidential historian we love to call on often for his insights. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for asking.
And this is a great theme. Excited about it, and we want to invite our listeners as we jump around in history a little bit to talk about, get our guests' views on the evolving role of first ladies in our history and so forth. We'd like to have our listeners chime in as well. Perhaps you'd like to tell us which first lady stands out in your mind and why. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. And we're going to be presenting some of the voices of the more contemporary first ladies. Of course, we can't go back to audio for the late 1700s, the founding fathers. Tim, start us off with the founding of our country. Was there any role foreseen for the first lady?
You know, Ben, as you suggest, there is no office. This is the spouse of the president of the United States. We made a decision to refer to our first president, President Washington, as Mr. President. But how do we address his wife? How do we address Martha Washington? And so the people essentially came up with Lady Washington, which is not necessarily where first lady came from, but it was a form of respect. It is, as you suggest, an unusual position because it's an unpaid position. It wasn't something that Martha Washington, you know, ran for or solicited. Yet it's a very public role. People were very conscious of who she was. She was quite approachable because she was going to be a social hostess for events to be held, not at the White House, because the Washingtons occupied a residence in Philadelphia and New York during the time before the White House was constructed. The First Lady was always seen as sympathetic, so perhaps has the ear of the president. And so they were often solicited with proposals and ideas. And people were, of course, very critical. They looked at their fashion. What was the First Lady wearing? What was going to be the trend in fashion? And yet, because of the proximity to the president, First ladies were seen as at least advisors and perhaps powerful. Now, not every first lady embraced the role, but those that did and who did in a very cautious, careful way, even in the 19th century, could influence their husbands.
And of course, Martha Washington, maybe 150 years before women even had the right to vote. 1920, the 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote. Diane Bystrom, your initial thoughts on first ladies in historical context?
Well, I think it's a really interesting topic, and certainly the role of the first lady, to me, the most interesting aspect is how it's evolved over time. Mm-hmm. For the largest part of history, basically a hostess, as Tim referred to, you know, social gatherings, being the hostess at the White House, ceremonial, until about the late 1960s, there was sort of an expectation that also a potential First Lady would be campaigning for their husband while he ran for president, and certainly in 2016 while she ran for president. And then beyond that, they've really expected to have sort of a social concern, one that is not divisive, but something that they can embrace. And so that is typical role now, and I think that's how they're evaluated primarily not only by the public, but by also historians and scholars.
Diane Bystrom, I know you've had a look at sort of a poll of historians that ranks first ladies. I don't tell us a little bit about this poll. How are they ranked? Who comes out on top most often?
Well, this has been done by the Siena Institute, which is at Siena College in New York, and they basically poll scholars and historians. So it's a little bit different than the Gallup poll, which also does favorability ratings of not only the president, but the first lady. But this poll of historians, and it comes out every 4 years, so we don't have a poll since 2014, and so there should be one coming out this spring. And so they poll historians on 10 different attributes that can include things like their background, their leadership ability, were they beneficial to their husband, what was their lasting legacy, what did they work on for women's issues. And what the latest poll shows, and this is basically pretty consistent over time, is that Eleanor Roosevelt typically is the top-rated first lady over time. She rates very high on many of those attributes. In the 2015 poll, Michelle Obama made her debut. She had, you know, not been first lady for very long when that happened in 2014. Well, I guess she had been, but she was rated fifth, and she bumped Hillary Clinton out of fifth place, and Hillary dropped to sixth. But typically the other first ladies that tend to rank pretty high are first ladies Abigail Adams, another historical one, certainly Martha Washington's in the top 10, Jacqueline Kennedy has been in the top 10. And so Lady Bird Johnson, Betty Ford, Rosalynn Carter, those typically are the ones that typically rate high.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the one who typically lands in the number one spot, Eleanor Roosevelt, among a poll of historians. Give us the short sort of elevator speech on Diane, on why Eleanor is so revered in that spot.
Well, I think she actually, I think, was the person who really embraced the role of the first lady and made it more public. She was the first lady to give her own press conferences. She built the first lady staff, so she actually staffed up during her time. She was a spokesperson, actually, on African-American and civil rights. And so she, I think her mark is that she was so different. You know, certainly if you look at the activist first ladies, the ones that come to mind are Abigail Adams, is seen as an activist, but certainly Eleanor Roosevelt, Hillary Clinton. And we don't know exactly where Michelle Obama is going to place historically, but my guess is that she'll be seen more in an active role as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit of Eleanor Roosevelt before Tim Walsh, you weigh in on her activism. Here's Eleanor Roosevelt addressing the United Nations on the ratification of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, this recording from Paris, France.
We stand today at the threshold of a great event, both in the life of the United Nations and in the life of mankind. This Universal Declaration of Human Rights may well become the international Magna Carta of all men everywhere. We hope its proclamation by the General Assembly will be an event comparable to the proclamation of the Declaration of the Rights of Man by the French people in 1789, the adoption of the Bill of Rights by the people of the United States, and the adoption of comparable declarations at different times in other countries.
Eleanor Roosevelt, going back to 1948 in Paris. Tim Walsh, your comment on this amazing woman.
Right. Extraordinary contribution to world governance and social values. She worked very hard as chairman of that commission and as our delegate to the United Nations to achieve that goal. And it's a worldwide significance. I wanted to stress what Diane said, how important Eleanor Roosevelt was for a number of different reasons, one of which, of course, her husband was limited in his mobility because of his paralysis. And so she really became his legs in a way and traveled the country. She had great, in many ways, was more liberal than he was and championed many social causes and individuals and regularly would deposit these lengthy memos in the inbox next to his bed. So the first thing he read before he went to bed at night, or the last thing he read before he went to bed at night and the first thing in the morning was a memo from Eleanor. And when people would come in and challenge him, he said, well, I just have to do what the missus tells me to do. So she was extraordinary. There's a wonderful cartoon in The New Yorker about these dirty miners down in a coal mine. And one looks to the other and over his shoulder and said, my goodness, it's Mrs. Roosevelt. And behind him is this woman in a fur collar marching into the mine to find out what the miners needed. So she really was an exceptional individual, a real paradigm shift among our first ladies. And as Diane suggested, she had the first press conferences. She invited women reporters for the first time into the White House. She had the first newspaper column. She, in effect, created a bully pulpit for the first ladies.
Mm-hmm. Diane, comment on this, the activism in this one facet of being a partner with the president. Some are partnered more closely than others. Some stay distant, and some, perhaps Eleanor is at the top of the list of those who have partnered to make their presidents more effective, their president more effective.
Well, I think so. And as Tim pointed out, I mean, I think one of the reasons she ends up being sort of the top pick by historians over time is that she did really change the role of the first lady. Part of it was because of President Roosevelt's lack of ability and physical ability when he became with polio. And so, you know, she really made the role different. I like the fact that Tim also pointed out that she made a role for women in the White House, women reporters were invited into her press conferences. And so I think that's why she stands over time. And certainly after serving as First Lady, she remained active in public life. You know, another thing I like to point out, my discipline is communication studies and so speech. And there's 100 speeches rated as the top 100 speeches in American history. And there's only 4 given by First Ladies, and Eleanor Roosevelt gave 2 of them, including the one that you just played.
Mm. First Ladies in Historical Perspective, our focus this hour, Diane Bystrom of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University, Tim Walsh, a presidential historian, formerly of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Ronald Reagan, one of the most revered presidents in modern times. Let's talk about First Lady Nancy Reagan. Let's hear a little bit of her before I get our comments from Diane and Tim. September 1986, you may remember this. First Lady Nancy Reagan warning Americans about drugs, including a then-new drug called crack.
Each of us has to put our principles and consciences on the line, whether in social settings or in the workplace, to set forth solid standards and stick to them. There's no moral middle ground. Indifference is not an option. We want you to help us create an outspoken intolerance for drug use. For the sake of our children, I implore each of you to be unyielding and inflexible in your opposition to drugs. Our young people are helping us lead the way. Not long ago in Oakland, California, I was asked by a group of children what to do if they were offered drugs. And I answered, just say no. Soon after that, those children in Oakland formed a Just Say No club. And now there are over 10,000 such clubs all over the country.
Okay, Nancy Reagan, First Lady, in 1986. Comment to Diane, also interesting there how our thoughts on drug addiction and rehabilitation have changed in the few decades between now and then.
Certainly I think Nancy Reagan is a good example of someone who not only embraced a current social cause at the time, but she came up with a catchy phrase, just say no.
Everybody knows that.
If you say just say no now, you think mm-hmm. of Nancy Reagan. One of the interesting things to me is that she was, in some ways, a fairly controversial first lady at the time. The Siena poll that I mentioned earlier actually had her ranking in the bottom 5 first ladies during a time while her husband was president in 1982, as well as 1993, when Bill Clinton was president. So she was ranked fairly low by historians. And again, she's another one somewhat like Eleanor Roosevelt, but sort of behind the scenes. I mean, she had a lot of power, again, especially later in President Reagan's administration. And she was known to be very powerful behind the scenes.
Right, right. And it was the chief of staff were not to cross Nancy Reagan, Tim Walsh.
And the early, the troika, Jim Baker and Ed Meese and Mike Deaver, who worked together to help elect the president, understood how important Nancy Reagan was to the president's well-being and how much her advice made a difference to him and how morose he got if she was away on some cause. They had a deep and loving relationship. And so they would regularly seek out her support for anything that they wanted to do because she was an important fourth in that group. When basically Don Regan became chief of staff, that was when, in effect, she began to clash and Regan had to go. So it really that's a very important relationship, as Diane suggests, somewhat behind the scenes. And as she also suggests, she was criticized for her fashion, criticized for ordering a new a tableware for White House china, which often gets broken or stolen and so forth. So in many ways, she took it on the chin for the president.
Did she also take it on the chin? And I hope I'm not spreading fake news here, but I mean, Nancy Reagan consulted astrologers.
She did. And in fact, I think that was revealed in Don Regan's memoir. So it was a kind of a
about
payback.
Auspicious days to do certain
Joan
things.
Joan Quigley, I think, was the name of the astrologer, if I'm right.
Diane, do you have any recollection of that?
Yes, I do. And actually, if you Google something like scandals and first ladies, Nancy Reagan comes up on those lists, including something that was put together by ABC News a couple years ago. And it was because of the astrology. And so that was something that was mentioned as sort of a secret or a scandal that a first lady held.
Mm-hmm. She's not the first, by the way, though, to dabble in the dark arts. Mary Todd Lincoln supposedly had seances in the White House, too. So, you know, they're humans.
But of that period, we had this sort of these sort of gatherings, seances and so forth from the 1800s into the 20th century, right? I mean, it was a big thing that we could contact spirits of bygone years.
Oh, I think it was more common for people to believe in that. But astrology and horoscopes are common in the 20th century as well. So
right,
not to
right.
defend having a White House astrologer, but, you know, I don't think that's a scandal, frankly. But.
Mary Todd Lincoln,
yes.
I see on the Diane comment on this, not one who ranked very well in her time?
Yeah, she was raised in a wealthy family, and she was criticized for spending a lot of government funding on her own wardrobe. That is something really today first ladies don't do. They actually are expected to buy their wardrobe out of their own personal funds or have it donated by designers. And so she was criticized for being a shopaholic. And she really had sort of a kind of an unfortunate disposition as well. And so she is not highly regarded. She finally made it out of the bottom five this year. She was consistently rated in the bottom five by historians. But this year, inched out of that, she's still in the bottom 10, but she's no longer in the bottom five.
Unfortunate disposition, Diane says. Can you elaborate on that, Tim?
Well, contributing to the problem was the fact that she had several of her relatives fought in the Confederate Army, and so coming from the South, she had high expectations for the office of being the social hostess with the mostest, so to speak. And of course, her husband's administration was caught up in the war, so social events were largely canceled during the time that President Lincoln was in office. So it was a difficult time. She suffered the loss of a child in the White House. One, I think, died before they entered the White House. So, it's a hard life. And in fact, we heard President Trump make reference in this speech in Pennsylvania about, you know, Melania doesn't have an easy life. And I would dare say that anybody who looks at the offer, the position of First Lady would say, this is a difficult task for anyone to take on.
Right. And Mary Todd Lincoln living more than half a century before women gained the right to vote. Diane, I suppose this activism could only have been ushered in after the suffrage movement.
Well, that's true, I think, for most first ladies, although Abigail Adams is famous, as you know, for telling her husband to remember the ladies. And so she gets points for activism before the passage of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. So she's actually noted as an activist first lady before women could have the right to vote because she held strong views on women's rights even back in those days. But certainly, I think after Eleanor Roosevelt, there's sort of an expectation and evaluation of first ladies to be activists or not. And it's really kind of a You know, it's a balancing act, because if you become too independent, like people saw Hillary Clinton doing when it was sort of two for, you know, you elect Bill Clinton, you get two for the price of one. She wanted to reform health care, which would be considered a quote unquote women's issue. But she actually got some pretty negative reviews at the start of her term as first lady because for sort of overstepping her bounds.
Diane's absolutely right. And I'd like to extend a shout out to two first ladies who were often forgotten, who were strong advisors to their husbands behind the scenes. And that's Sarah Polk, the wife of James K. Polk, and Helen Taft, the wife of William Howard Taft, both of whom were intellectuals, well-read, had strong opinions, shared them with their husbands, but not with anybody else. So as Diane suggests, you had to do it in a kind of a sub rosa fashion, but they were both very important in their own way.
Were there any, we're assuming, I mean, in all of our presidents, or correct me, have we had any presidents without first ladies? Any presidents who were bachelors, Tim?
James Buchanan.
Buchanan.
Was without a spouse, and I think a niece acted on his behalf. And poor Jane Pierce suffered the loss of their, I think their own, first of all, she didn't want her husband to run for president. He ran anyway. He was elected, and shortly thereafter, their son was killed in a train accident. She spent 4 years in the White House residence, and I don't think ever came downstairs or hosted any kind of social event. She was a recluse. Mm-hmm. It was a very sad experience for her.
Mm-hmm. And Diane, we have present First Lady Melania Trump initially did not live in the White House.
Yes, and that's very unusual as well. And the thing that's interesting to me about that is that Michelle Obama, who also had young children at the time, two girls in school in Chicago, she apparently contemplated staying in Chicago for that the spring of 2009 so her girls could finish out their schools. And she was advised by President Obama's advisors that that would not be acceptable, that she would cause all sorts of problems, maybe even for the president. And so she really needed to move into the White House. And so she did that. She uprooted her daughters from their schools in Chicago, moved into the White House after the inauguration in 2009. And it's interesting then because Melania Trump, you know, for the same reasons, wanting to keep Barron in school in New York City, stayed there and really didn't receive a lot of criticism. So in some ways, I kind of see it as a good thing because it's sort of changing the role a little bit in the expectations. I think that's the one thing about first ladies is that they're always being measured by previous first ladies. And mm-hmm. So for Michelle Obama not to be able to do this because she feared to be criticized, but Melania Trump did it. And basically, I think people understood that she was being a good mom by doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back after a short break, we'll continue our conversation of first ladies in U.S. history. And I want to zero in on a little bit more on what Diane mentioned a moment ago, the criticism that Hillary Clinton received at the beginning of her her time as a first lady. And when we come back, we'll hear the voice of Hillary Clinton from the 1992 presidential race, one she was very criticized for, and it has to do with baking something that we all love to eat. Perhaps that jolts something in your brain to bring back a quote. We'll play it for you when we come back. Diane Bystrom, Tim Walsh, First Ladies in History. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, looking at first ladies in America's history, 47 of them, ending with the current first lady, Melania Trump. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps you'd like to ask about a first lady that stands out in your mind, 1-866-780-9100. Diane Bystrom is with us, director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics at ISU. Tim Walsh, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library. And we've talked about Eleanor Roosevelt. We've talked about Nancy Reagan, a little bit about Hillary Clinton. Let's talk a little bit more about her. And here's probably more than any other thing that she said, she created got a lot of flack for this comment. A moment from the 1992 presidential race, comment from Hillary Clinton that sparked controversy about feminism and women's rights.
I suppose I could have stayed home and baked cookies and had teas, but what I decided to do was to fulfill my profession, which I entered before my husband was in public life.
Okay. Do I have that right, Diane? Probably one of the most controversial things she uttered, right?
Well, it was controversial at the time, but, you know, to point out, she actually was the first lady that had a professional career before being first lady. Mm-hmm. And so, she, again, somewhat like an Eleanor Roosevelt, she expanded the role of the first lady. She certainly expanded the background of first lady and what was appropriate. And so, you know, my feeling was when I heard that, you know, and I think some, it probably resonated with some professional women at the time, you know, entering the workforce, is that, you know, that they'd be seen more independent. But as we both sort of mentioned earlier, there are these expectations for the first lady. Although they're supposed to have a social cause, they also, their number one job is really being to support the president and putting their husband and children before all else. And so it is kind of a tightrope that you're expected to not only support the president and have a social cause, but not to be too independent.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear another clip of First Lady Hillary Clinton. Here she is talking about health care reform. Met by both cheers and jeers. This is at Seattle's Westlake Center in 1994.
You know, every generation or so, a great issue takes the imagination of our country. 60 years ago, it was Social Security, when President Roosevelt said, if you work hard for a living, you should not be in poverty when you reach your older years. And he fought hard for Social Security, and the very same people who were against Social Security are against health care reform. Then 30 years later, when Medicare was fought for, the very same people who were against Medicare are against health care reform. You know, if we had listened to those people, we wouldn't have even settled Washington, because nobody would have gotten on a wagon train, because they would have been told they couldn't do it. I am tired.
Diane, I don't know the background of the cheers and jeers there, too, but you heard it as well as I did. But we can go back to this time and remember the charge that the Clintons, both of them, made for a health care reform that met a brick wall, I think. Right, Diane?
Well, yes. And look at today. I mean, we still are arguing over health care and health care reform. And so that is an issue that I think as a country we have not tackled. And it's an unpopular issue. And it certainly was at the time. And she got booed for it. Again, you know, in some ways, healthcare is considered in some ways an acceptable social concern for a first lady. Michelle Obama took on something similarly, but it was more with childhood obesity, that sort of issue, and nutrition. But healthcare is typically seen, or the subject of health is typically seen as an appropriate issue for first ladies. But the reform part of it, I think, is where we hear the boos for Hillary Clinton. I should also point out that she also gave the most top-rated speech as a first lady when she spoke in Beijing. And had the phrase women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights. And so she was really revered. In the Siena poll, she's been ranked in the top five since she was first lady every time they've done the poll. So certainly historians have been kind to her contributions as first lady.
Absolutely. What Diane is saying is right on. I wanted to mention, too, of course, what added to her controversial role or status on health care was, of course, she was put into the position of leading the commission by her husband, which in and of itself was somewhat controversial. It was a controversial topic, health care, and then having the first lady chair the commission added to it. He also, of course, was very proud of her and was common to or during the campaign would make statements like, well, you know, if you elect me, you're getting two for one, because she really is the bright one in the family. She's the capable one. And I think that rubbed people the wrong way. They thought the first lady was getting, or at least Hillary Clinton was getting too big or too ambitious for the position that they wanted to keep it in. So we've had ambivalent feelings about first ladies. We like the fact that they're very approachable. We like the fact that they can reach the president. On the other hand, we like a more traditional view of the hostess, or as Diane suggested, a non-controversial approach to an important issue.
Tim Walsh, presidential historian, Diane Bystrom, a political scientist of Iowa State University. Let's go to the phones. James dialed 1-866-780-9100. James, I see on my screen you're calling from outside of Iowa. May I ask where you are?
Yes, sir. James Bennett. I live in the North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia area. You'll have to forgive me. I'm being treated for cancer right now in my throat.
We can hear you just fine, James. I hope that's going well. And
thank
you for tuning into Iowa Public Radio. What do you have to chip
in? Oh, absolutely. We listen online to you folks as often as I can. So thank you for being there. Yes, I've always been very, and you'll have to forgive me, a little bit emotional with the cancer, but often been very impressed by Rosalynn Carter. You know, she was the very first to stress mental health, to my knowledge, her very first public interview. She stressed that. And as you know, it's been largely ignored since then.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they come up with this as a magic answer for our present problems, but she saw it even then. She also reached out to prior first ladies like Miss Johnson, and also Miss Ford, and I think she helped forge a long-term permanent relationship between she and the Fords. And then she also reached out to across the world, but particularly to Latin America, which we continue to ignore too much. And then she even sat in on cabinet meetings, but she did it in a non-intrusive fashion. All she did was took notes. She never spoke or interrupted.
This is your topic, James. We're glad you called up, and we appreciate it. Let's get a little input from our guest. James, thank you so much for calling today.
Thank you all so much. Good day.
Good day to you. Diane, comment on Rosalynn Carter, an interesting first lady.
Yes, and she has been in the Siena poll. She has been in the top 10 every single year of the poll, so certainly revered again by historians for her role. Sometimes, if you haven't forgotten, her nickname was the Steel Magnolia.
Yes.
So she was known as being, as James just said, very, you know, she kept quiet. She was behind the scenes, but those who dealt with her, she had a demeanor of steel. So she was both sweet, but she was also very determined. She did a lot in the field of mental health, and again, I think she's is really seen by all historians that are polled by Siena as being one of the top 10 first ladies of history.
Another very popular first lady. Our time is running out. I wanted to get to a few others. Laura Bush established a semi-annual National Book Festival in 2001, encouraged education on a worldwide scale. Here she is talking with a reporter the day of the first National Book Festival in Washington, D.C.
One thing that I like about both this festival, the National Book Festival and the Texas Book Festival, is that they're right here in the Capitol. We're right now on the steps of the Library of Congress with the United States Capitol behind us, and I love the whole idea and the symbolism of books and the ideas in books with our national government and our democracy, because the ideas in books are really what are so important to our democracy.
Laura Bush, also representing the U.S. during her foreign trips, tending to focus on HIV and AIDS, malaria awareness. Tim Walsh, what a magnificent woman.
She was, and much like her mother-in-law, Barbara Bush, they were both strong advocates of literacy and supporting all forms of learning and education, very gracious. And she's maintained a high score among historians and others in public opinion polls, even when her husband's ratings, when George W. Bush was somewhat controversial, Laura Bush was seen as a kind of a paragon of virtue. And again, very approachable, very gracious, very supportive. She was she hosted the directors of presidential libraries at a conference at Camp David, which was an extraordinary event in my own career of 30 years to be able to talk to her. And she had very high opinions of Iowa because, of course, of the Iowa Writing Workshop. So bottom line was, an exceptional first lady.
Mm-hmm. I want to read a message from one of our listeners, Suzanne in Grinnell, would like you, Tim, and Diane to comment on what she feels is a double standard between Michelle Obama's decision to move her children and Melania Trump's decision to wait to move to D.C. Michelle had to deal, Suzanne writes, with being the first African-American first lady, which brought challenges, and she had to work to double to combat them, Suzanne writing. Diane, comment on what Suzanne's thoughts are there.
I think she's absolutely right. I recently gave a guest lecture in a class at Iowa State looking at Michelle Obama's rhetorical evolution as first lady. And certainly what I concluded, and many others have, is that she faced even stronger constraints, not only as a first lady, but, you know, she also came from a background where she was a lawyer, highly accomplished, and really being the first African-American first lady. So certainly there were a lot of constraints on her. And if you remember her 2008 convention speech, she came across as mom in chief. And so she basically went from mom in chief to talking about the American dream in 2012 until 2016, when she gave that highly regarded speech at the Democratic National Convention that nominated Hillary Clinton, when she recognized her race and the fact that she was living in a house built by slaves.
Well, in fact, we have a bit of that audio, that including that exact part, Diane. Here's First Lady Michelle Obama speaking at the Democratic National Convention, pretty emotionally charged arena there, also watching on TV, I remember this, at the Democratic National Convention in 2016.
That is the story of this country, the story that has brought me to this stage tonight. The story of generations of people who felt the lash of bondage, the shame of servitude, the sting of segregation, but who kept on striving and hoping and doing what needed to be done, so that today I wake up every morning in a house that was built by slaves. And I watch my daughters, two beautiful, intelligent black young women, playing with their dogs on the White House lawn.
Michelle Obama in 2016. Tim, comment.
Well, it's just, it was an exceptional kind of transformative event, her time as First Lady, as was her husband's time as President of the United States. And so I think they were always being very careful with every conscious decision they made about where to send their children to school, what sorts of causes and events that Mrs. Obama would become involved in, as was the case with the president. You know, we always refer to President Obama as no drama Obama. Well, in many ways, it was no drama Mrs. Obama as well. It was a very careful, measured, substantive tenure as first lady, and for which she will continue to get high remarks, but not controversial in almost any way that I can think of. Mm-hmm.
Diane, comment on what Suzanne and Grinnell also wanted to comment on. I mean, the first black first lady facing a lot of criticism, bullying online because of her race, you think?
Well, I think that there were both. I mean, again, she was came out of a professional background. She tried to be, like Tim said, very careful. What I remember the biggest thing about Michelle Obama is that she was often criticized for her clothes, which just seems, odd when we think about it today, where we have the first lady as a former model. And so, Michelle Obama, once she wore a sleeveless dress, and she was criticized online for wearing a sleeveless dress. President Obama was criticized for wearing a tan suit.
It
really, when you think about it now, and for those of us who have looked at not only presidents but first ladies over time, is certainly right now, I do think there is a double standard. I mean, I'm hoping that I agree that there's a double standard between the expectations for Michelle Obama or Hillary Clinton and mm-hmm. what they seem to be for Melania Trump. I guess I'm also hoping that with these double standards and with these expectations, maybe the role of the first lady will continue to evolve. And so it'll be interesting to see. Certainly Melania Trump hasn't really done anything that traditional or recent first ladies have done. She hasn't moved into the White House. She didn't campaign for her husband. She hasn't announced, she's announced she's interested in cyberbullying, but there doesn't seem to be anything launched yet. And so certainly there's different expectations for her, but they seem to be different expectations for the president as well.
One of the things that stands out for Melania Trump, perhaps our news listeners will remember, is she faced accusations of plagiarizing former First Lady Michelle Obama during her speech at the National Republican convention. Here's a snippet of what Melania Trump's speech in 2016, side by side with Michelle Obama's speech in 2008. Let's listen.
Because we want our children in this nation to know that the only limit to your achievements is the strength of your dreams and your willingness to work for them.
And Barack and I set out to build lives guided by these values and to pass them on to the next generation, because we want our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
Okay. Diane, she received a lot of not a great first impression, I guess we have to say there, when these plagiarizing, these charges of plagiarism were brought out.
Yeah. And, you know, I listened to her speech when I was watching the Republican National Convention that year. And I sat there thinking, well, this is really a great speech. But then the thing that stood out to me is, and you didn't play it, is that they also talked about your word is your bond. And that was something that stood out, because I remember Michelle Obama saying that. And then quickly, I think before she'd even finished her speech, it was out on Twitter that the speech had been was substantively the same as Michelle Obama's speech. I think from 2012 it was. Mm-hmm. You know, what I read later is that Melania Trump, you know, really admired Michelle Obama's speech, and whoever wrote it, I don't know who wrote it. First she said she wrote it, and then she said someone on Trump's staff wrote it. But it seems like she actually admired her speech, and in doing so, some of the phraseology got put in her speech as well. Mm-hmm.
Here's one reaching way back as the hour ends. Email from Kathleen, one of our listeners, asking, how does John Quincy Adams' wife, Catherine Adams, rate? I was impressed by the story of her travel from Moscow to Paris in the winter of 1815 with her small son arriving near Paris as Napoleon was also arriving there to try to regain power. Has any other first lady had to take on that kind of physically perilous task? I don't know if either of our guests know about that.
This was before she was first lady, we should remark, because her father was in the diplomatic service. He was an American citizen, but her mother, I think, was French, and she spoke French better than she spoke English. She was not particularly comfortable as a first lady during the years from 1825 to 1829, but neither was her husband all that comfortable being president of the United States. What's interesting there to note is that she's the first lady to be born outside the United States, I believe. Mm-hmm. But she was an American citizen. And mm-hmm. Melania Trump, of course, is the first naturalized American citizen, becoming a citizen, I think, in 2006. So they have a little bit of a bond, and they both probably struggled with English.
Mm-hmm. As we come down here, Diane, anything on your list to throw out about first ladies that you think is significant?
Well, I think one of the things you had Laura Bush on before, and I think one thing that stands out, in addition to this poll I've been talking about by historians, Gallup also has been polling for years, not only favorability of the president, but of first ladies. And Laura Bush has the all-time highest favorability ratings of any first lady. She was at 85% in 2005. And as you noted earlier, she was really more popular than her husband at that time. The only other two first ladies that have hit that 80% mark or near it are Hillary Clinton in 1999, and also Michelle Obama in 2009 was at 79%. Melania Trump is just at 47%, but still rated higher than her husband by Gallup. And it's increased from 36% in a year. So it's gone up from 36% to 47%.
Final words, Tim Ault.
I just want to say that many people feel more comfortable writing or communicating with the First Lady as a portal to reach the president. And among us historians, we find a tremendous response from the American people directly to the president through the First Lady. So it's an important office and an important way to reach our presidents.
Mm-hmm. I remember asking Hillary Clinton, this would have been in 2007 when she was campaigning the first time for president, what Bill Clinton would be called should she become president. It was at the tail end of an interview I did with her. I think she said first gentleman. Diane, any thoughts on how, when we eventually have a first gentleman or first dude or whatever he will be called instead of a first lady, how that will change the role?
Well, I think it will change the role. And I really did expect, had Hillary Clinton been elected president, I think that Bill Clinton in some ways would have been very appropriate to sort of expand that role, because I think he would have been more of an activist. I don't think he could help himself by doing anything else.
I think everyone agrees on that. Right.
And so I think he would have been a great first gentleman, because I think that he would have really embraced the role.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much. What a delightful hour with your insights. Diane Bystrom, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. Tim Walsh, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, presidential historian. We'll look forward to the next theme that we capture and have you back. Tim, Diane, thank you so much.
And thanks
to our listeners as well. Some nice input from our listeners as well. Thank you both. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, of course, it's a Politics Wednesday edition. We woke up to, it was after many of us woke up, the ouster of Secretary of State Tillerson. We'll talk about that, him being replaced by CIA Chief Pompeo. We continue. And also, we'll have state politics. Senator Dix losing his position. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.